Welcome to Island Issues, our weekly public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns. Brought to you by Regency at Hualalai, a retirement and assisted living community. Listen Sundays at 6:30 a.m. on KKOA 107.7 FM or at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. Or to the podcast at lava1053.com or koacountry1077.com. Now here's your host and producer, Sherry Brackett.
Aloha. Good Sunday morning. Welcome to Island Issues. Ocean health, critical to the planet, critical to our life here on the Big Island. In 2016, I spoke with Dr. Drew Harvell of Cornell University when she was here for the Waimea Ocean Film Festival about work she's been doing on this island for Kohala Center in Puako and elsewhere, and about other work with which she's involved. We also talked about a spectacular glass collection which she curates at Cornell University. When Dr. Harvell was here again for the Waimea Ocean Film Festival just last month, she gave an update on her work and also talked about a new book she has coming out about the topic called Ocean Outbreak. Today, we will listen again to our discussion from 2016, and next Sunday, February 24th, in what will be my final Island Issues here on Lava 105 and Koa Country Radio, we will air my recent update with Dr. Harvell. As we listen to the 2016 interview, important to note that this was recorded 3 years ago, just after our extremely warm summer of 2015. Let's get to our interview from 2016, which I recorded then at the Waimea Ocean Film Festival. Drew Harvell is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Cornell University. She's authored more than 120 research papers that have appeared in scholarly journals, and she's widely recognized for work on the health of marine ecosystems. Dr. Harvell's laboratory research focuses on the ecology of infectious disease and ocean sustainability. That includes taking a look at the impacts of a warming climate on coral reef ecosystems. Dr. Harvell is a senior scientist with the Kohala Center here on Hawaii Island. And she also, at Cornell University, is curator of the Blashka Marine Invertebrate Collection. Aloha, Dr. Harvell.
Aloha, Sherry. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you for taking the time. And before we talk about some of the work you have talked about here at the Waimea Ocean Film Festival, tell us what your work is with Kohala Center here on the island.
Well, it's been a long-term partnership. The Kohala Center has aided a program that we've done with our students. We bring our Cornell students for a full semester, and they participate in a lot of research projects. The one that I've been most involved with has been the health of the coral reefs in Puako, and we've worked there for almost half a decade now, studying the quality of the water and working with the residents to understand how better to reduce pollution in their local waters. Because especially in a year like this, where there's a lot of warming stress on the corals, it makes a focus on the local factors that we can actually change all the more important.
Actually, that's an interesting point you bring up. How can we personally impact that coral reef? Because we've all seen, if we look at all at the coral in our ocean waters here off Hawaii Island, we've seen that some of the corals we have are bleaching, and we're attributing that to the warming ocean. But how do we affect that?
Well, the bleaching is huge this year in Hawaii. Throughout, first hit in the northwest Hawaiian Islands, very big hit there, throughout all of the main Hawaiian Islands, and still persists after months to this day. So it's a unprecedented large bleaching. We can't really affect that, but we can reduce the local stressors and give our corals a little bit of a better chance to recover. And a big local stressor is the pollutants that we put in the water, whether it's sewage, whether it's runoff from golf courses, whether it's industrial runoff. These are huge stressors for corals.
One of the things you mentioned in one of the lectures I heard you give was that some corals can, in fact, recover from bleaching. Just talk briefly about that, because that would be important to think that maybe we have recovery as a possibility.
So, you know, it's a really good question. Is a coral a plant or an animal? Well, the interesting answer is that they're both. They're an animal that houses a symbiotic plant in their tissues that they require that makes all their food for them, basically. So they're solar-powered. The trick is, though, in this symbiosis, the Achilles heel is warming. The algae is sensitive to even slight warming temperatures, and they're expelled. So when a coral turns white, it's because it's lost its algal symbiont, its source of food. And if it's just a mild bleaching event, they can reacquire them because these algae live in the sediments and the water nearby. But in a case like this, where it's been such a long, several months long bleaching event, a lot of these corals probably are going to die or pick up infectious diseases because, you know, they're just susceptible and stressed.
I'm curious, Dr. Harvell, how did you first get interested in this whole field of marine biology, ocean ecology?
Oh, my goodness. Let me see. Well, it went way back to when I was an undergrad, and I've always loved our spineless biodiversity. I just am endlessly fascinated by starfish, squid, octopus, sea slugs, and corals. So I'd say it just started off with a love of biodiversity, and then a real interest in the ecological patterns, what drives patterns in our undersea seascape. And then, of course, with all of the impacts we've had on sustainability of our reefs, you know, a desire to find ways to make these ecosystems more sustainable.
Cornell University, which is your primary day job, I understand, is one of several universities to have glass pieces created by a famous and talented glass craftsman in the 1800s and into the early 1900s. The father Leopold and the son Rudolf Blaschka created what look like remarkable life-size depictions of invertebrates that live in the ocean, creatures like jellyfish, sea worms, anemones, things like that. And you're the curator of this collection at Cornell University. Tell us about this glass collection. Why did these gentlemen make all these glass models? How did this come about? What does Cornell do with them?
Wow, what a treasure that I get to be curator of. Cornell has, we think, the largest collection of these in the world of over 560 pieces. There are 60 other universities that have collections of the Blaschka glass sea animals. They're a little less well known than the more famous glass flowers that the Blaschkas also created that are housed at Harvard. So the Blaschkas created them for teaching. They worked exclusively on soft-bodied critters, so things like sea slugs and jellyfish, like you said, that just can't be preserved. And in the 1860s, it was really a problem for students to learn about these. The Blaschkas were obsessive in their attention to detail. For every one of the animals they created are exact replicas of a particular species. And the collection that Cornell bought in the 1860s was a teaching collection to teach their students. And it's kind of fun because I still use it now. I send my students out to our case and require them to identify the particular species and classes or phyla of invertebrates and appreciate the amazing diversity. Some of these critters I have never even seen in the ocean. They're so rare.
How lifelike are these glass creations, and how did the Blaschkas, well, let's start with how lifelike are they?
Well, one of my favorite things to do, Sherry, is to show people pictures side by side of the glass and the living animal, and about half the time they can't pick out which is which. So they really are perfect in terms of how close a match they are to the way the living animal looks.
So how did the Blaschkas get to see these creatures to make the glass? I'm just curious about that, since it sounds like they really did become really good teaching tools.
Well, you know, there's always a question about who in history would you want to go back and spend time with? I would want to go back and spend time with Leopold Blaschka and just have been able to watch their transformation over time, because they initially started copying pictures from taxonomic experts like Haeckel and Gauss, and then they just became so obsessed that they started to work from living animals, and then they started to order them. I mean, imagine an 1860 writing a letter to a marine station and saying, you know, I want 30 of your most common beautiful marine invertebrates, I want 5 worms, 6 sea anemones, 10 octopus, and pack them in algae and mail them to me. And sure enough, I guess that happened, and then they would set up aquaria in Dresden and keep these critters alive while they studied them and did glass pieces of them.
Back in the day, clearly the students wouldn't have had the ability to go diving in the ocean. The technology that would have allowed that just did not exist, like, well, diving tanks and things like that. Today, your students can go in the water, and you go in the water, so I'm curious. I don't know if you can give a percentage, but are you finding these same creatures still alive today? Are these creatures that existed in 1860 still part of the ecosystem, or are they gone?
You know, our quest to go back and find the living representatives initially seemed like an easy idea. Well, we'll just go out and try to find them. And initially we thought maybe it wasn't going to be a happy story, that some of them would be extinct, that a lot of them might be endangered. And it's been really pretty exciting and hopeful. We find a lot of them. I can't give you a percentage because we're not done. It actually turns out to be a rather large job finding these critters, but we're finding a lot of them. Some of them are quite common. Sometimes it's sad. For example, in the Mediterranean, I found a whole bunch of the octopus and squid in the fish market, which wasn't my happy place to find them, but it was good in the sense that they must be common enough that they were showing up in the markets. And it was kind of funny because the Italians are different than us. In the Italian markets, they actually have the species name for the squid and the octopus and the cuttlefish that they have on sale. So it was really easy to match them up. Yeah.
Well, that was very nice of them to do it that way for your benefit. If somebody gets back to Cornell University, can they see this glass collection, or do you have it purely behind doors for students?
Oh, it's available to be seen. It's in my building, Corson Hall, at Cornell University. We also have an exhibition in Mann Library and one in our Johnson Library. There will be a large exhibition of them in our Johnson Museum. And in particular, Corning Museum of Glass is going to show almost 100 of our pieces in an exhibition. So if people are in New York, come and see them.
Dr. Harvell, the National Science Foundation is working with the National Institutes of Health on a series of initiatives called Ecology and Evolution of Infectious Diseases Program. And I know you're involved with it. So first, what is the objective of this overall multi-part initiative? Because at first when I started to look at this, I thought it was just you looking at the ocean, but I realized this is a much broader thing. There's 9 different segments, and they're looking at all kinds of infectious diseases. And maybe I've answered my own question, but tell us anything you know.
Well, we were early on involved with the National Science Foundation. Part of that, it funded some of our work on diseases of corals and the immune system and how corals fight disease. But of course, as you point out, Sherry, this is a much broader program. And, you know, it's based in the observation that we actually don't know a lot about the ecology, the dynamics of how a lot of these diseases, whether they're human or wildlife, are transmitted in nature. For example, what are the reservoirs for something like Ebola? What's the ecology? What conditions allow it to suddenly erupt into human populations? Or a project we're working on now, we're studying transmission of a viral disease in starfish. And so there's a lot of mysteries about what's happening in nature that's affecting risk of disease, both to our wildlife and even to humans. I currently lead a program, a research coordination network for the ecology of marine infectious disease. It's a team of over 30 marine biologists studying lots of different diseases that affect marine organisms, from corals to abalones to clams to starfish and even marine mammals.
When you talk about infectious diseases in the ocean, are these diseases that are actually spread from one animal to another animal, from one species to another? Or give us a little more history of this, because I think most of us are more familiar with what happens in people, but not so much with what might be happening in the ocean.
Well, as you can imagine, the ocean is a little bit out of sight and out of mind, Sherry. And I would say one of the big black boxes in the ocean is understanding what we call transmission, how infectious disease does get transmitted from one individual to another, or even what the reservoirs are. So, for example, one of our coral diseases, it's called white pox disease in the Atlantic off the coast of Florida, is actually transmitted to corals through human sewage. So the bacterium is called Serratium marcescens, and the virulent form of that bacteria was originated in human sewage. And so, you know, these are obviously some of the land-based pollution issues that we want to avoid in the ocean. In terms of the starfish epidemic that we've been studying, the virus that's causative there is, you know, being newly studied by Ian Hewson at Cornell, and we don't know a lot yet about how it's actually transmitted among individuals and or what the reservoirs are in the ocean. So that's a big black box for us. Some of the viruses of the marine mammals are transmitted, for example, morbillivirus, which is similar to canine distemper of dogs, is actually transmitted, you know, in social events between seals or dolphins. So there's a whole range of ways these things are transmitted.
And a brief interruption to remind you, this is Island Issues, which has aired on Koa Country and Lava 105 since December 2014. I'm your host and producer, Sherry Bracken. This interview with Dr. Drew Harvell of Cornell University and the Kohala Center was recorded in January 2016 after the extreme warming events that started in the summer of 2015. You remember here on the island, we had 14 or 15, maybe even 16 named hurricanes. We had torrential rain on the island, especially on the west side. And those of you who spend any time in the water could see the coral being affected. Next Sunday, Dr. Drew Harvell gives us an update. How are things with the ocean? How is coral doing? What's the latest on some of the species that she uses to gauge the ocean health? Dr. Drew Harvell has a new book coming out in about a month called Ocean Outbreak, which has already gotten terrific reviews in the New York Times, the Atlantic, Science Magazine. So join us next week for my final Island Issues interview here on Lava 105 in Koa Country, 6:30 a.m. on Koa Country, 107.7 FM, or 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. And that interview, as all, will be posted for anytime listening at lava1053.com and at koacountry1077.com. Click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone. Now, back to the 2016 discussion with Dr. Drew Harvell.
You mentioned the sea star issue. Give us a little detail about that. Where are these sea stars? What's the problem? Tell us more about that, because that sounds like that right now is a big thing on which you're working.
Yeah, in 2013, marine divers and marine ecologists noticed a couple of species of sea stars starting to die in fairly cataclysmic events where thousands of stars were falling off the walls and dying underwater. And then it grew to an epidemic that involved over 20 species of our West Coast stars, killing upwards of 90% of them in some places. For example, all of our monitoring was in the San Juan Islands in Washington State. And for several of our species, we've found over 90% mortality. One of the common subtidal ones is virtually unfindable at this point and is affected all the way from Mexico up to Alaska. So this was a very rapidly progressing epidemic. We were fortunate in having a colleague at Cornell University, Ian Hewson, who is a virologist. There are not very many echinoderm virologists in the world, and was able to identify a causative virus that was causing this outbreak. And at this point, it has spread beyond our shores, so it's turning into what looks like a global pandemic, affecting largely starfish, although there's some questions about whether there's other groups affected as well.
So let's say that we'll take the starfish. Let's say that you remove the starfish from the equation completely. The starfish die. How does that affect the ocean and marine life and biodiversity? Help us understand why it's an important thing.
Oh, that's such a good question, Sherry. So starfish have been identified as what we call keystone species because even a few of them in nature can really just change the seascape. So the big thing that some of these stars do is they control whether you have mussels on your shore, whether you have sea urchins on your shore. And we kind of know how that works for a couple of the different species of stars, but to remove 20 species of these keystone predators is having a really big impact. We're finding local outbreaks of sea urchins in some locations and mussels in other locations. So there's a lot of interest among marine ecologists to document the impact of removing these keystone species.
So why are you having an outbreak of sea urchins or mussels because the stars die? What's the relationship of the stars to the urchins and the mussels?
Stars are voracious predators. They're kind of like the lions of the deep, and they can totally gobble up tons of mussels in the intertidal. And they also eat, some of the other species eat a lot of baby sea urchins. So you can imagine millions and millions of baby sea urchins raining into the subtidal and these starfish running around gobbling them all up. And the stars aren't there now, so all of those sea urchins are surviving. And they, in turn, like to eat kelp. And so what's happening in some locations is we're having outbreaks of the sea urchins, which are then mowing down the kelp beds, which of course you understand are essential marine habitat for a lot of fish and other species. So we do expect cascading impacts to our seascape from the removal of these stars.
I take it it's too early in your study of the sea stars to tell what caused this to begin, and that leads me to ask, here we are in Hawaii where the ocean is a huge part of our life. Are we in danger here of having similar kinds of situations occur?
Yeah, in general, we do find that under warming conditions, there tend to be more disease outbreaks. One of my colleagues characterized it as a warmer world is a sicker world. And it's because under warming conditions, sometimes the hosts become stressed. Corals, of course, are a perfect example of that. But also a lot of our microorganisms that are infectious tend to cycle a little faster. They grow a little faster. They're maybe below their optimal temperature. So you kind of have a double whammy under warming conditions that can create more of these sorts of disease outbreaks. And then if you add to that, we have a fundamentally different situation in the ocean because we have no way to manage or control an infectious disease once it gets in. We can't quarantine, we can't cull, and we really don't have effective vaccines for ocean-based diseases. So we're a little bit behind the curve here in having the kind of management protocols that we need for dealing with this increasing realm of infectious disease in the ocean.
I'm so depressed.
I'm sorry. This is the bad thing. Let's go back to the Velasquez because that's hopeful and fun.
Yeah. It's not your fault that I get depressed when I hear about this.
I get a little bit too enthusiastic about this because it really does worry me.
Well, yeah, it's a big worry. Dr. Harville, none of this sounds really encouraging, but I'm hoping you can tell us something encouraging to make us think there might be some ability to address these kinds of issues in the future.
I think there's a lot we can do, and focusing on improved management of infectious disease is a very good idea. One of the problems is when a disease outbreak happens, it's fast. It's like a lightning strike. And so a new bill was introduced in Congress by Congressman Denny Heck of Washington State called the Emergency Marine Disease Act. And it's exactly the kind of thing that's needed to sort of free up funds on a really quickly moving basis when these things happen to our essential marine habitat. The other thing, there's some pretty obvious stuff, like we can dial back our sewage, which is adding infectious diseases to the ocean, and being very careful with aquaculture, which is another source of infectious agents that can affect our wildlife.
Dr. Harville, you have a book coming out. Tell us about it.
Oh, I'm really excited about this. Sometimes the management of climate warming and infectious disease gets me down, but it's a really happy thing to, again, celebrate the biodiversity we have in the oceans. And our Blaschka project kind of reminds me to do that. The book is about the fact that marine biodiversity is as fragile as glass, and it details our quest of going back and looking for the living animals that inspired the Blaschka glass, and the happy story that actually we're finding a lot of them, and then how some of these marine critters are emblematic of the ecological threats we have in the ocean. Obviously, the corals with warming, some of the sea butterflies that are affected by ocean acidification. So I try to tell the story about all of marine biodiversity through this lens of the beautiful art collection.
What's the name of the book?
The name of the book is A Sea of Glass, published by the University of California Press.
I wanted to ask you, the film that you showed about searching for the species showed a lot of really beautiful things like the nudibranchs, which are little sluggy kind of things with brilliant colors. And I've been lucky enough to see a number of those diving in the Caribbean, especially not so much here in Hawaii, although a little bit here in Hawaii. So the question is, are those kind of species surviving? Is there hope for them, or do you see them declining?
The fun thing about the Blaschka project and why it was so much fun to write that book, actually, is that there's a lot of hope. A lot of those soft-bodied creatures are thriving in our oceans. We found there's actually nudibranchs, sea slugs, the brightly colored orange and blue and yellow, red, are quite abundant in today's oceans, so we've found quite a few of them.
What else are you working on, if there's anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, in general, the work in my lab is with infectious diseases. One of our big projects now, in addition to the sea star outbreak, is studying diseases of seagrasses, which are essential marine habitat. In the Pacific Northwest, in fact, the whole West Coast, seagrasses are affected by a protozoan disease that's slowly eating away at our beds. And like many of the projects in our lab, it's affected by temperature. And so we're studying how temperature and warming events affect outbreaks of this disease of our essential marine habitat, seagrasses.
You sort of answered this before, but when you see things like that, are there any solutions?
We're really interested in solutions. With seagrasses, we're interested in what kinds of factors might dial back the levels of those diseases. For example, how sensitive are they to nutrients? Maybe cleaning up the waters will reduce the impacts.
Dr. Harvell, if there are young people on this island who want to go into a field similar to yours, marine biology, anything in that field, how should they be preparing from the time they're young?
Well, young people on this island have a real advantage as marine biologists because they're here. So they can just be spending their time enjoying nature in the water, learning everything they can about their marine background. And then when they get to high school, they'll be experts with the marine organisms and they can sort of focus on some of the harder science. A perfect example is one of my most talented students who's working with me today as a coordinator in our program. His name is Ren Yoshioka. He graduated from Hilo High, an absolute obsessive naturalist about marine critters, started taking my courses at Cornell University, quickly became involved as an honor student, did work in Puuko on coral health that's being published, his honors thesis from Cornell, and stands as one of the most talented students I've ever had. He's worked for us for 2 years as our coordinator of my marine undergraduate programs in marine sciences, an amazing photographer, and will be going on to graduate school to earn his own PhD and carry on. So he's a perfect role model for kids on the big island.
Well, I'm really excited to hear that. And one reason is that sometimes it's thought that one has to have the resources to go to private school all the way from grammar school, middle school, high school. And pretty clearly, since Ren went to Hilo High, that's not the case. He's a public school kid.
Obviously, that seemed to work. He's an absolutely super talented student, graduated at the very top from Cornell, and has amazing quantitative skills and statistics, as well as this very artistic side of being a talented photographer and just an absolutely wonderful coordinator for our program.
That is absolutely great. Thank you so much for sharing that story. It's always absolutely delightful to hear about Hawaii Island kids who go on to success. You mentioned kids taking science. What are the science classes that kids should take in high school if they do in fact have an interest in marine biology?
Well, I think it's important that they do have some quantitative skills, so they should be taking some math, some chemistry, some physics, but for our work, biology is obviously really central.
Anything else before we say aloha?
Oh, you've asked so many wonderful questions, Sherry. I'm really very grateful to be on your show, and I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Drew Harvell.
And before we say aloha, after this interview with Dr. Drew Harvell, which was recorded in January of 2016 at the Waimea Ocean Film Festival, which happens every January up in the north part of Hawaii Island, an update on Ren Yoshioka, of whom Dr. Harvell was so complimentary. His parents are Miles and Wendy Yoshioka. Miles is with Hawaii Island Chamber of Commerce, and Wendy has a job with the state. Ren is a PhD student at the University of Oregon's Oregon Institute of Marine Biology, and he tells me that his studies are still very influenced by his time working with Dr. Harvell. Ren is studying eelgrass wasting disease, and next Sunday morning, when we air our next interview with Dr. Harvell, which we recorded after we heard her give a talk at the Waimea Ocean Film Festival in January, Dr. Harvell will be telling us what the contributions of eelgrass are to ocean health. This is Island Issues, and I'm your host and producer, Sherry Bracken. Thank you so much to our listeners for being with us. I definitely appreciate you, and you're what has helped me do this program for more than 14 years now. Next Sunday morning, join us for my follow-up interview with Dr. Drew Harvell. Until then, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahoi ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues, brought to you by Regency at Hualalai, a retirement and assisted living community. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us at info@labo105.com. Join us again next week for another Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Islands Mahalo Multimedia.